Well, good morning to you. My name is Jonathan, and I'm so glad to serve as one of the pastors here at North Central. And we're so glad you're here this morning as we're into week five of our sermon series on the book of 1 Timothy. And our big idea this morning, right out of the gate here, is from 1 Timothy 3 and the beginning of chapter 4. Okay, that's the end of chapter 3, the beginning of chapter 4 is kind of where we're going to hang out. And our big idea is this: the nature and the purpose of the church will not be thwarted if it holds fast to the gospel. And you have probably noticed that we've titled this series True or False. Because in this letter to Timothy, one of the things that Paul is trying to do is help Timothy discern the difference between the truth about Jesus and some of the false teaching that is kind of going around in that day and age and in that environment. It's kind of infiltrating the church. So Timothy is in this city called Ephesus, and Ephesus was known for its worship of other gods. Okay, so Timothy's environment would have been very saturated with idolatry and all different kinds of religious practices that really ran contrary to the way of Jesus. So Paul is kind of reading the room here. He's reading the room, he's reading the culture, and he needs to help his spiritual son, Timothy, kind of figure out what is going on. Right? And of course, that's how we end up with this letter. But here's what amazes me. This letter is heavily influenced by the culture. Okay? Kind of the context of what's happening in that time and in that place. And yet, somehow, it's still massively important in helping us understand how the church should function and really what we should be about as a church family. And I gotta say, I find that so fascinating. I really do. These letters are the very earliest Christian writings, but they still speak, right? They still speak to our culture and our day with just massive weight and massive importance. Why is that? Well, it's because the same things that Paul is warning Timothy about, those things are still with us. Right, we're still up against idolatry, though it often kind of takes a different shape. And we're still up against leaders and teachers that are not to be trusted. And so Paul is kind of sounding the alarm here to help Timothy discern the truth. So about a month ago, Megan and I were in Colorado. And she had a work conference out there, and we also have some really wonderful close friends that live in Colorado. So I decided to tag along and go with her. And I don't know if you've ever been to Colorado. If you have, you know how dynamic the landscape is out there, right? We're on kind of the front range of the Rockies. And if you like adventure sports, like I do, it's just next level. Really, it's just one of the coolest places in the world, one of the best spots in the world for that sort of thing. Well, one of the things I've always wanted to do is whitewater rafting. And I'll say that in this situation, ignorance is probably bliss, because I think if we knew some of the dangers, right, associated with whitewater rafting, I think Megan would have shut the whole thing down long before we ever planned it. So we show up to this dusty little outpost in the middle of nowhere, Colorado. And they suit us up with wetsuits, right? And life jackets, and they throw helmets on us. Like, okay. They stick us in this old, like, beat-up school bus, and they drive us to our launch spot, okay? And that's probably like a 25-minute ride down into the Arkansas River Basin. And for the entirety of the bus ride, the whole thing, all 25 minutes, one of the guides is giving a safety talk. And he's going through all the different scenarios of what could happen on the raft. For example, if the boat capsizes, do not try to touch the bottom of the river with your foot. Because here's what he tells us. What can happen is your foot can get caught because it's all rocky, big rocks under there. Your foot will get caught. And the river is so strong that while your foot's caught, the river is pushing you down under the water. So he says, if that happens, you have about a minute to live. Okay? You'll be dead in 1 minute. He says, oh, by the way, multiple people die like that every year on the river. Oh, and also the water is from the Rocky Mountains. It's snow melt, so it's 40 degrees. So you can also die from hypothermia. It's just like story after story like this. And all the ways you could die or be seriously injured. So at the end of the bus ride, I'm thinking, like, we should probably call the kids. You know, just call them, because I think this is probably the end of the line for us. This whole thing seems way too sketchy. I should also mention that when we got down to the river, they tell us this. They say the water, by the way, is at its absolute max height. If it was 1 inch higher, no one is allowed to go out because it's unsafe. Like, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, right? But if the river is safe now, but if it goes up one more inch, it's unsafe. It's like, okay, yeah, I got it. All right. So you're probably thinking, like, why in the world would you go through with this? You've heard all the dangers, right? All the potential for disaster, even death. There's got to be something wrong with you, and there probably is. There probably is. I know my mom back there thinks that there is. But let me tell you why we did it. Yeah, it's probably the first time my mom's even hearing this story. for good reason. But let me tell you why we did it. Our guide, his name is Kurt, and when we got down to the water, Kurt told us something that really helped. He said, if you listen to my instructions and you do exactly what I'm telling you to do, I'm going to keep you safe. Okay? I can't guarantee that we won't capsize. And that we won't all be swimming. He's like, that's happened to me multiple times already this year. But if you do listen to my instructions and you do exactly what I'm telling you to do, you're going to have a positive outcome. And we're going to have a great day on the river. And here's another thing that Kurt did. Early on, as we're heading downriver, we're in the boat, we're heading downriver, and the water's moving quickly, but we're not in the rapids yet. So it's still kind of relatively calm. And he says, guys, I've got full control of where the boat is aimed. And he says, let me prove it to you. So he says, look up to that rock formation there. And we'd look at it, and almost instantly the boat would turn and face the rock formation. And he'd say, like, look up to the left there. You see that hawk up there? And the boat would do this. And we're not doing it. He's doing it, right? Steering. So I'll tell you, like, that's a boost of confidence that gave us, right? Here's a guy who's been doing this for, like, 30 years. He's got loads of experience. He's telling us, I've got our steering. And he says, I also know that you've heard the horror stories on the bus, but if you listen to my voice and you do what I'm telling you to do, you're going to have a good outcome. And let me tell you, we went out and we just attacked that river. It's level 4, level 5 rapids for 9 miles we did. Waves bigger than me, taller than me, crashing over us. Here we are. That's me in the front. That's Megan right behind me. I'm on the left. There we are, going underwater, right? It was moments like this that I thought, my wife is in the water. She's washed out, right? She's supposed to be behind me. I'd look back. I'd think, she's gone. She's still there. Big smile on her face. You know, here we are coming back up. And she's a fairly risk-averse person. So I said, babe, how did you do that? Like, weren't you scared? And she says, I'm a rule follower. I am a rule follower. And Kurt said, stay in the boat. So I stayed in the boat. And that's, honestly, that's exactly the picture I want you guys to have in your head as we examine 1 Timothy. Right throughout this series. Because Paul is saying to Timothy, it is dangerous. It's dangerous out there. There's any number of false teachings. There's idolatry. There's pagan religions. So many things that are trying to harm this fledgling church of Jesus, even our own forgetful hearts, right? But if you listen to my voice, Timothy, if you listen to truth, and you do what I'm telling you to do, we're going to have a good outcome. And so Paul's like a guide. He's like a guide for us. He's re-aiming the church when it wanders. And like I said, it's still as relevant as ever. So what's he saying to Timothy here in our passage? Let's check it out together. This is chapter 3, verse 14 and verse 15. He says, I'm writing these things to you now, even though I hope to be with you soon, so that if I'm delayed, you will know how people must conduct themselves in the household of God. This is the church of the living God, which is the pillar and foundation of the truth. So let's just hang out there for a minute. There's a couple things that I want to point out here at the end of chapter 3. And really what Paul is describing here is the nature, and he's describing the purpose of the church. In other words, what even is the gathered church? What does it do? Right? What's its purpose? So the nature of the church. Notice that he calls it the household of God. That word household, that's a familial term. It's part of a family, right? The church is the family of God. So what happens in a family? Well, it's intimate, right? It's close-knit relationships. And that tells us that the church is so much more than just an institution, isn't it? Or an organization. It's a family. It's a family where we share deep personal connections with one another, don't we? It's just like a household. So maybe you've found this in your own life as well, but my very deepest and closest friendships are with other believers in Jesus. I know that's true for my wife. I'm finding that that's true for my kids, which I'm so grateful for. And here's why I think that's so important. I've got a number of close relationships with friends that don't know and love Jesus, and they're wonderful. And those friendships are especially meaningful when things are good. Right? And life's celebrations roll around. And you know, things like weddings and birthdays and parties. And, you know, they know how to celebrate, right? They know how to party, which is wonderful, and it's important. But here's where those relationships can fall a little bit short. There's many celebrations in life, but there's also many difficulties, right? There's many sorrows. A diagnosis that comes along, or a death in the family, or a divorce that happens. Maybe seeing your children or your grandchildren suffering in some way, going through something hard. And we already know what the normal human response and reaction is to those things, right? It's anger. It's despair. Oftentimes it's anger at God. Because we think he should have stopped it, right? He should have stopped it from ever happening in the first place. And it's in moments like those when our heart is frustrated and our heart is angry that we need God's family, right? We need God's family to come around us and not just express like thoughts and prayers, right? As they say, right? But how about getting in the ditch with us, right? Grieve with us first and eventually remind us of what we know to be true about our God, right? Remind us of the hope that we have. That's what a family does. That's the nature of the household, the family of God. And how about the purpose of the gathered church? What's its purpose? Paul says something very specific here in verse 15 that I want to point out. He says that this household is the, quote, church of the living God. Well, we're going to go back a little ways here and talk about what the church used to look like, okay, before Jesus. And I think that'll hopefully give us a little bit of context. And forgive me if I nerd out a little bit here, but I find this to be so helpful. So, listen, long before Jesus, God provided a way for Israel, his people, to be with him. You remember that? It was like an agreement. And at this agreement's core were three main things. Before I tell you those main things, here's the scenario. This is what's happening. Don't forget this. God's holy. Man is sinful, and those two things cannot coexist. They can't commingle, especially under normal circumstances. So here's what's required when the people gather, like we do right now, under the old agreement, okay? They needed three things. Here's what they are. They needed a temple, and that's the dwelling place for God. Secondly, they needed a priest. The priest is a mediator for the people. He's the kind of the go-between. And they also needed a sacrifice. And the sacrifice would atone for, or kind of pay for, the sin of the people. But here's the problem. The people had time and time again broken that agreement, that covenant with God. And they had begun to worship other gods. And so God, in his really unending mercy, says, okay, even though you are unfaithful to me, I will never be unfaithful to you. In fact, there's this amazing story in Genesis 15. And we're just going to do a quick flyover here. But God is making this agreement, this covenant with Abram. And when covenants were made in the ancient Near East, there are certain rituals that would happen, that would accompany this agreement, kind of a ceremony, that would signify what would happen if one of the parties failed to live up to the agreement, if they failed to live up to their end of the deal. And this is a little bit gory, but one common ritual involved, listen to this, cutting an animal in half, and then they would lay the two pieces in two rows, like side by side, and in between would be a path. And then the two parties who were making the agreement, they would walk between the animals, and they would actually invoke a curse on themselves if they failed to keep their end of the agreement. Essentially, what they're saying is, in effect, if I don't fulfill the terms, then what happened to these animals here, like, let that happen to me, okay? So that's heavy. That's heavy, heavy stuff. And here's what's so interesting about this story. In this story of God's agreement, God doesn't invite, like you normally would, he does not invite Abram to walk through the pieces. Only God walks through the pieces. Now, there's a lot there. There's a lot to kind of unpack, but here's all I want for you to catch today. It's that even though we're disloyal, even though we're forgetful, God will always keep his end of the bargain. He'll always, always keep his end of the deal. He'll go to the greatest lengths imaginable to do it, even to death. Now, keep that in mind, but I want to fast forward, okay? All through Paul's writings, we're shown that Jesus replaces, okay, Jesus replaces this focus of Israel's gathering, which is the temple, the priest, and the sacrifice. Jesus replaces those. But still, the author of Hebrews says, don't stop meeting together. Don't neglect meeting together, which seems a little odd, right? If Jesus had come to enact this new agreement where he replaces these three elements, the temple, the priest, the sacrifice, then why gather? Like, why gather at all? Why bother? Jesus replaced the whole thing, right? And here's what we see. The gathering's purpose shifts, and it shifts towards the work of the church, which is actually to encourage one another. Like, encourage one another to what? Well, number one, to stop forgetting. Forgetfulness is nothing new for us, right? From the very beginning, we're profoundly forgetful. And the consequences of forgetting God are not good, to say the least. And this is part of God's design. It's part of his design for helping us remember. It's this. It's the gathering. It's what we're doing right now, right? It's the local church. And I think this is a helpful way to picture it, this little analogy. When we get together, it's very similar to when a married couple renews their vows. They're not starting something new when they reaffirm their love, right? Instead, they're saying, despite everything that's happened over the years, we're still committed to one another. I find that so beautiful. In a worship gathering, it's very similar. The church comes together to hear the gospel, hear it anew, respond in faith, and we're reaffirming that God's promise still stands. We remain his people, he remains our God, and we're standing on this new covenant. right? This new agreement. I don't know if you know this, but it's no small thing when Christians get together. Because listen to this, when a Christian shows up, God shows up. You ever consider that? Paul says in 1 Corinthians, do you not know that you're God's temple and that God's Spirit dwells in you? So, when the church gathers, it gathers as a collection of people in which God lives. And I find that so fascinating. The Christ in me meets the Christ in you. So now, because of the indwelling Holy Spirit, God no longer inhabits a temple, but what does he inhabit? He inhabits his people, right? You see the shift? Another way of saying that is the church is not a building anymore of brick or wood. It's a people. It's a people. And that's a major shift. Of course, culturally, we still call the place that we gather to worship church, right? But the reality is this is just a building. It's just a building. You are the church. I'm the church. And you know what? When the church gathers, something incredible takes place. And there's an author named Mike Cosper. He puts it this way. He says, the church is an outpost of hope in a dying world, a fellowship of resurrected sinners whose presence in the world is a foretaste of a greater transformation to come. And I love that. That's how we should see the gathering of the local church. It's an outpost of hope. What are we? We're resurrected sinners, right? We're pointing to a resurrected Savior. And that's exactly how Paul puts it in our text here in 1 Timothy. He calls it the church of the living God. All right, so we've got this, the church as this pillar of truth, kind of this beacon of hope, so to speak. And then Paul goes on to sort of summarize what the church believes in a short poem. And he calls it a mystery. And I want to look at it together. This is verse 16. He says, without question, this is a great mystery of our faith. Christ was revealed in a human body and vindicated by the Spirit. He was seen by angels and announced to the nations. He was believed in throughout the world and taken to heaven in glory. So in that little bit of poetry, Paul is covering a lot of ground, isn't he? And he's saying, this is really just a profound little reminder to Timothy what we believe, right? What are the core beliefs of the church? And Paul does that often in his writing. He'll sort of hit you with a statement that kind of lifts your eyes, right? It reminds you of the supremacy of Jesus, like he does in Colossians 1. All that Jesus has done, and I think that's so helpful because he also, Paul, needs to do some correcting. In other words, he sort of needs us to see the truth. He needs us to see the truth before he points out what the lie is. Makes sense. And that's what we see here at the beginning of chapter 4. Because if everything in that poem is true, and Jesus really is who he says he is, and if God really is revealed in the flesh, as this says, and he's raised to life by the Spirit and seen by angels, and if he really was believed in throughout the world and ascended to heaven, if all that's true, Timothy, then would you believe that there's some false teachers? And they're going around, and they are saying some things that in order to achieve righteousness, you need to abstain from some things, right? And that's actually how you're made right with God, by abstaining from some things. So this is Paul, really. Paul's like the whitewater rafting guide, okay? He's saying, whoa. Like, that's dangerous. That's dangerous water. That is going to capsize your faith in a hurry. So Timothy, listen to my voice, and let's look at what he says here in chapter 4. He says, now, the Holy Spirit tells us clearly that in the last time, some will turn away from the true faith. They'll follow deceptive spirits and teachings that come from demons. These people are hypocrites and liars, and their consciences are dead. They will say it is wrong to be married and wrong to eat certain foods. But God created those foods to be eaten with thanks by faithful people who know the truth. Since everything God created is good, we should not reject any of it, but receive it with thanks. For we know God for we know it is made acceptable by the word of God and prayer. All right, so here's the first thing that really strikes me about this passage. Paul says, here's what we've got. We've got hypocrites, we've got liars, and they've got dead consciences. And notice he says that they're actually following spirits and demons. And those are some strong descriptors, aren't they? I'm thinking Paul is getting ready to say, listen, like these people are holding satanic rituals, like they're sacrificing children, or they're like, I don't know, any number of things. But he's not saying that. He's actually saying these people think it's wrong to be married and wrong to eat certain foods, which that seems harsh. That seems very harsh. Don't eat certain foods. Don't get married. I'm not sure I would describe that as demonic. So what's going on here? Like, why would Paul use such strong language? And here's what's happening. There's a philosophy, then, that had gained some momentum in the Greco-Roman world. And honestly, the root of it is still around today, and it's called asceticism. Asceticism. And here are some of the tenets of asceticism. It says that if you detach yourself from physical pleasure, okay, material possessions, you can have inner peace and harmony. It also says that if you include dietary restrictions, you live a celibate life, that'll help you purify your soul and achieve a harmonious life. And lastly, it says that if you abstain from meat and wine and sexual activity, that'll help you prepare your soul for its journey after death. And to Paul, those ideas are an absolute assault on the faith. He finds them totally ridiculous and really incompatible with the gospel. And here's why. Because if you're forbidding marriage, you're forbidding something that God created, right? Something that God instituted. And that's undermining the goodness of God's creation. He says everything created by God is good, and nothing should be rejected, especially if it's received with thanksgiving. So that's the first problem. The second problem is, if abstaining from something is a way to be right with God, then that's the root, really, of legalism. And legalism says that if you simply effort, okay, if you simply work hard enough and you do exactly what's being prescribed, then you can achieve salvation. So really, it's in your own hands. You sort of wield the power. Essentially, it's self-rescue. Huge problem for Paul, right? He's been preaching that salvation is through faith, not the law. Actually, in Romans 10, he says that Jesus fulfilled the law. And so what's happening in Ephesus here, where they're imposing these dietary restrictions and restrictions on marriage, well, that works to deny the freedom and the completeness of what Jesus did and what Jesus accomplished. And I think if you sort of translate that warning that he's giving into modern life, it becomes a lot more subtle. Like, it's a little more difficult for us to spot, because I think a literal reading of that doesn't look very closely at it, it just says, hey, it's okay to eat meat, right? And it's okay to get married. Got it. Like, not a problem, Paul. I'm actually in total agreement with you. I like all kinds of food. I like meat. I like marriage. Boom. You know, what else you got? But a closer look at this is actually going to show us there's a much bigger problem. And here's what I mean. And this is an example from my own story. So for most of my life, if you would have asked me, are you a Christian, Jonathan? My response would have been, I'm trying to be. I'm doing my best. You know, I'm trying to keep up. And really, that doesn't sound so bad, does it? Right? I'm doing my best. At least I'm efforting towards it. But here's what's underpinning that, and it's this. It's the idea that if I do everything right, and if I have the perfect day, and if I try super hard, then God's going to be happy with me. I don't know if you've ever thought that way. Or if God just knows that I did my best, you know, then that's really what counts. Even if I fail, even if I fall short, at least he knows I'm trying. And here's what I would call that. I would call that a low view of God and a high view of self. That's a low view of God and a high view of self, because what God requires must not be very much, because I think I can actually reach it. Right? That's a low view of God, a high view of self. Or maybe by keeping myself from something, in Paul's letter here to Timothy, he's saying it's marriage. And there's certain foods, right? Stay away from those if you want to be godly. That's what the culture was saying. And sometimes we kind of fall into that same line of thinking. And, you know, it's all the things we should do and all the things we shouldn't do. And maybe if we don't swear. And maybe if, you know, we don't overeat, or if we don't dance, or if we don't drink a glass of wine, or if we, you know, listen to certain kinds of music, or, you know, as long as we don't cheat, as long as we're not stealing something, right? I mean, you name it. The list goes on and on. And I would say this, if that's the means by which we are right with God, then I have to say it again, that's a low view of God. That's a low view of God, and it's a high view of self. As if we're going to somehow reach his incredible, like, glorious standard of perfection by our behavior. But even more than that, Paul says that's demonic. That's a demonic influence. Because it claims that the work of Jesus is insufficient. Right? Now, I do think there's wisdom in making good decisions, of course, right? About what to eat and what to drink and what to allow into our minds. Of course there is. Of course there is. But the second that that crosses over into the belief that what I do or what I don't do is how I'm justified before God, Paul says that's dangerous water. That is dangerous water. So dangerous. And here's what we're seeing. We're seeing that the faith of believers is rooted in the truth and the grace of Jesus rather than in human traditions and ascetic practices. So what in the world does that mean? What does that mean for us? What now? You know, what do we do with that? And the first thing I would say is this. We've got to remember the nature and the purpose of the gathered church. The reason that we gather isn't to feel good about ourselves. It's not to check a box, right? When we gather together, we're the household of God, right? We're the family of God. Does not mean we're perfect. Does not mean we have it all together. Lord knows that we do not. Sometimes when someone hears you, that you attend a church, especially on a weekly basis, they might say something like, man, you must be good. Like, you must be a really good person, or you must be perfect. And actually, the exact opposite is true, right? We're here because we know what we deserve, but we also know what we've gotten instead. And we desperately don't want to forget God's gift of grace. And the second thing I would say is this. Remember the nature and the purpose of your rescue. The nature and the purpose of your rescue. A friend of mine uses this analogy. He says that imagine you're at home and you're watching the Olympics, just like we're doing right now, and you've got swimming on. And you're just kind of relaxing on the couch. You're doing your thing. Maybe you're eating a snack or two or three. But somehow, like in a Marvel movie, you get sucked into a parallel universe, okay? And suddenly, you find yourself in the Olympic swimming arena, and somehow you're standing on the starting block, okay? And it dawns on you, you're about to be in this race. And to make matters worse, it's the 1500, right? It's nearly a mile. 32 lengths of the pool back and forth. By the way, this is my absolute worst nightmare. So the race is almost ready. Okay, it's almost ready to start, and you might be thinking one of two things. The first is, not only am I not going to medal, I'm going to die. Like the whole world is going to see it. I'm going to get halfway down this pool on the first lap, and I'm going to sink to the bottom. And that is going to be it. The second thought you might be having is, you know, I'm not that bad of a swimmer. Like, I've got a pool at home. I don't know, I've been swimming a while, I've been watching a lot of swimming on TV, I might actually have a little shot here. And of course, you've utterly lied to yourself in that scenario, right? You're for sure also going to die. Well, if you're getting set to go, imagine this. Just before the starting bell, you feel a tap on your shoulder. And you turn around, and it's Katie Ledecky, one of the two greatest swimmers to ever live. She's got 8 gold medals. And Katie says, "Hey, I see what you're about to do here. And trust me, it's not going to go well, but I've got you covered." And suddenly that bell goes off and she dives in past you. And you watch from the platform while she swims the perfect 1500. It's the perfect race. She wins the gold medal. Everyone's going wild. And at the medal ceremony, Katie invites you up onto the platform with her. Somehow, even though you've done nothing, in fact, your attempt would have been a total disaster, you get the credit for having swum the perfect race. And guys, that's a small picture. It's a small picture of what the nature of our salvation is like. Even if we effort at it, even if we try our very best, we still fall so laughably short. Why? Because we didn't just need an example, right? We needed a substitute. Not only did Jesus get the victory for us, he gave his life to do it, right? He lived the perfect life. He died the death that we deserved. And by his mercy, we get the credit, right? It's applied to us. The gold medal is ours. And here's the thing. Once we understand that, our response should be, "God, what do you want me to do?" See that? It's not that there's nothing to do. I know I've done nothing to earn the gift that you've given me, but I know I can't sit back and do nothing with it, right? That's the nature of our salvation. This gift of grace gives the church its purpose, and we've got the very best news to give the world. We really do. One of the ways that we remember that is through the taking of communion together. So we're going to do that. And I just want to encourage you that if you've not received Jesus yet, it's okay not to participate. What we're doing through communion isn't an act that somehow makes us right with God. Instead, Jesus said, do this to remember, right? To remind us of what he's done to put us in right relationship with God. So let's look at it together. This is 1 Corinthians 11. It says this. "For I pass on to you what I received from the Lord himself. And on the night when he was betrayed, the Lord Jesus took some bread, and he gave thanks to God for it. Then he broke it in pieces, and he said, 'This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me.'" So let's go ahead and eat together. "And then in the same way, he took the cup of wine after supper, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant between God and his people. An agreement confirmed with my blood. Do this in remembrance of me as often as you drink it. For every time you eat this bread and drink this cup, you are announcing the Lord's death until he comes again." Let's go ahead and drink together. And guys, we're going to spend a little bit of time singing, but also we're going to do some prayer. So if you are a leader in our church family, I want to invite you up to the front here. And there's a couple categories of people that I'm hoping would be willing to come up for prayer this morning. And the first is if you need physical healing in your body, we believe that God heals and that he still does miracles. So we would love it if you need prayer for some kind of sickness or infirmity that you have, please come forward and receive that. The second thing is this. If you have been trying, and if you've been efforting to please God, if you've been keeping track of a list of things that you either do or do not do, and you think that that is a way that pleases God, and you've been just been stuck on this hamster wheel, and you've forgotten the gospel, or maybe you don't know the gospel, the good news of all that Jesus has done, what he's accomplished, and how it's been applied to you, how you get the credit for what Jesus has done and accomplished. Man, that is an incredible truth once it settles into your heart. So if you need prayer regarding that, I want to invite you forward for that as well. So why don't we stand together? We're going to close with a song, and please feel free to come forward and receive prayer from this wonderful group of people up here.